This is Kate Harness with 307 Net Radio, and today I'm joined by Sylvia Brunner, who's the director of the Jim Gatchell Museum. Hello, Sylvia, how are you?
Doing great, thank you, Kate.
Thank you for spending some time with us. It's a very exciting time for the museum. You have just been awarded the Museum and Library Services National Medal.
Yes.
For 2023, which is a really big deal.
It is.
Can you explain to us what this award actually is and why it's so important?
So the Institute for Museum and Library Services is the federal branch that handles and distributes grant funding to museums and libraries, and also sets the standards, sets that high bar of what these types of institutions are supposed to be doing. There's kind of two organizations that museums particularly look to for direction and guidance, and that's IMLS and the American Alliance of Museums. So the National Medal is their yearly award that is given for literally doing the best that you can be doing. And it is highly competitive. There were a few hundred applications, and that was filtered down to 15 finalists in each category. And then when the awardees were selected, they determined four in each category, four museums, four libraries. So it is quite literally the highest award that a museum in the United States can receive.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
So, interesting, what kind of criteria were applied to see whether, you know, you even qualified to kind of get on a shortlist? What sort of things are they looking for?
So the application packet asks us for everything. You know, they need to know about your organizational structure, your finances, your governance, your staffing. But I think the heart of the award itself and that criteria really revolves around our community programming, the services that we offer to our community. That's what they're looking for, because you can have, a very efficiently ran and well-funded institution, but if they aren't doing anything for and with their community of value, then it begs the question of what is their purpose.
So how does that work for a museum? Because I think we think of a museum as being a building that people go into and they walk around and there are exhibits, and hopefully the exhibits are well presented and there are interesting things and nicely presented descriptions about them. But how does that work?
I think that's really been the kind of the child of change for many years now in museums in general. Museums really did used to have that kind of cabinet of curiosities set up where it was just a static display. Usually everything had a label and it might be manned by a curator or somebody who put it all out there, and that was it. That encompassed the whole package. But for quite a number of years now, there has been a shift in what people are actually wanting out of museums, and a lot of that comes down to they want programming and access and information, publications, you know, a wide variety. And I think a lot of that also stems from how museums have been accessible to some people, but maybe not everybody. So if you are, especially a public institution, and we're umbrellaed into the county as an ancillary, it is our duty to be as accessible to everybody across every demographic as well as we can. So if somebody can't physically come to the museum, how else can they gain something of use? If they can't come in because they can't afford an admission, how else can they use the museum? You know, on a personal level, I have always felt that you can't take family members' items, photographs, documents, and stories, and then turn around and deny them access to it. That is a part of the inherent mission of a museum. So when we get a research request that says, well, I think you have a photograph of my grandfather, can I access it? The answer is a resounding yes. The flip side of that is, yeah, we only have three people here. We're short-staffed. We need some advance notice, kind of general manners types of things. But our purpose to exist is to preserve the history and to present it to everybody.
So for somebody who maybe hasn't visited the museum or hasn't visited the museum in a while, because you're constantly growing and evolving, what actually is on display here?
So our museum is organized in a chronological but also a thematic manner. As you start with the oldest history, and that is like our wildlife, our dinosaurs, all of the flora and fauna of Johnson County. You go through Native American, frontier military, the Johnson County Cattle War, which is a huge topic, and a very broadly known topic. And then you learn about the Basque culture of this area, Jim Gatchell's pharmacy, early Buffalo history, and that encompasses everything from, you know, Vernon Keyes, who designed the Wyoming state flag, and the World War II airplane crash in the Bighorn Mountains. And then we have this space kind of reserved for changing exhibits. You know, the current one that just opened features D. Michael Thomas bronze art pieces. It previously had an exhibit about businesses that existed on Main Street. So that one room, although we wish it was larger, it does provide us with the ability to change things in and out on a fairly frequent basis. And that's important because people need a reason to come back. You want to see something different. It also gives us the opportunity to feature things like this exhibit. All of the items on display are actually on loan to us. We don't own all of those bronzes. Frankly, we don't have storage space for them if we did own them. So Mike Thomas, in his generosity, has lent them to us for a 2-year time period, and we get the opportunity to show his beautiful art to the community. So our museum does encompass a really broad range, and that is because a lot has happened in Johnson County. So we have, it's easy because there's a lot to work with.
And you can actually, I mean, you can wander through the museum and you can recognize lots of last names, lots of families. You might even know them just from street names, but also in person, because there are multiple generations still living in our community. So do you have a sort of a typical type of visitor? What kind of people? We obviously have a huge tourist season. Mm-hmm. Our economy is, really pinned to the success of our attracting visitors, and visitors do like to go to museums. So seasonally, I would expect you see an uptick. But what kind of people are coming to museums these days?
You know, this time of year, we see a lot of the older demographics of people traveling. I think a lot of folks hit the road before school is out, so there's maybe a few less families on the road, but we'll start to see a real rise in family travel. And I think we get a lot of people who just generically visit museums, one, because maybe they're interested in history, two, because they also know that it's usually a good location to kind of turn the family loose, stretch your legs, get some air conditioning, so they're looking at the really pragmatic reasons of it, too. I would say that for a lot of our visitors that specifically come to Buffalo and stop here, they know about the Johnson County Cattle War. They maybe know a little piece and they want to learn more because they're fascinated by that. Or they're particularly interested in our region's Native American history and culture, too. So those, I think, are two of our top topics of interest that cause people to stop.
What about younger visitors? I mean, you learn maybe from your parents or your family to kind of, mm-hmm. that museums are somewhere that you might want to come and visit. What do you do to kind of reach out and encourage younger people to want to come to a museum?
That's a really good question because, I don't know how to reach a younger demographic of like out-of-state visitors, but for our more local community and region, that's really where programming is key. You know, between the programming that Jennifer Romanowski does within the schools, with the schools, collaborating with a variety of other agencies, she is reaching our local youth at a huge variety of ages and encouraging them to take an interest. That's also where our art program in the summertime has been massively influential. The program, again, is already full. It just took off with popularity. But those kids that are attending that program, they signed up because they wanted to learn about art, and then they get to experience a little bit of the museum. And we've seen a lot of those young folks bring their families in and say, I wanted to bring mom and dad through because I thought this was super cool. And that's a local group that may not have ever set foot through the doors before. So we're super lucky that we have an artist on staff. We have Kelsey McDonald here to share her knowledge and her joy in art, and then that's also translating into recruiting for young people to be interested in history.
So we live in a digital age where most things are available literally at the touch of a button or a click of a finger and so on. What are the conversations that are happening in the museum business, so to speak, in the museum industry about staying relevant as time goes forward?
I think that's a really interesting topic because from what I have seen, you know, maybe 10, 15 years ago, I feel like there was a big concern of, well, if you digitize too much of your collection and you put it online, then people won't have cause to actually come to your museum. They're just going to look at it on the internet. The opposite of that has actually proven to be true. So the more accessible you do make things, the more interest people tend to have in actually coming to your facility, participating in your programs, you know, finding those different avenues. The other thing is, I think there is an inherent quality of seeing something in person, real life. And no matter how digital we get, that still exists. We see folks that come in from other states and they say, well, I'm pretty sure there's something from my family that's, you know, was donated here years ago. Is it on exhibit? I really want to see it. We can send them a photograph via email, but they want to see it in person. And that, I don't think, is ever going to go away.
That need or that sort of intrinsic desire for human connection.
It's a connection thing, for sure.
It's absolutely there, for sure. So, what, in your view, makes a great standout museum? You've won an award. What do you think was particularly attractive to the judges with this Jim Gatchell museum?
You know, I'm guessing. I haven't been told this, but I would suspect that one of the things that maybe tipped us over the edge for them is how much we have been able to accomplish and the high standards that we have held with only having 3 full-time staff and a budget of about $330,000 a year.
Right.
You know, I at first had that real flabbergasted kind of reaction that we made it into the finalist category because we were up against the Franklin Institute from Philadelphia. We're talking the Benjamin Franklin Institute. They opened, I think, in 1829. You know, in my mind, that is a massive institution. It's, you know, larger in every way you look at it. But maybe if you're comparing, say they have a staff of 50 and they have a budget that's 10 times our size, but their output and what they're doing isn't 10 times our output, then it's not an equal kind of comparison. So maybe that's kind of what tipped us over. Personally, I think a great museum is one that strives to be changing. And I know that sounds kind of conflicting because museums are supposed to be preserving the past. But you also have to change with your changing community. You know, what this museum looked like 20 years ago when I first started is very different from what it looks like today.
Can you explain that? Describe what that,
well,
what you mean by this?
So I began working here in October of 2003, and I think a lot of our local folks will still remember this too. The buildings weren't connected yet. There was an actual little alleyway between the Carnegie Library building and the museum proper. It was not handicapped accessible to come into the Carnegie because there's stairs everywhere. When you went into the museum itself, the ground floor was kind of one big room, and there were glass cases on the walls, and they jutted out. They had glass shelves, so it was kind of difficult sometimes for your eye to focus on an item because you were also seeing through all these multiple layers of glass. It was really cool, I think, for its time period, honestly, and it was very well built. But you start to run into the practical issues, too. Glass shattering, chipping, things of that nature. The basement, one big room. There was a wall of saddles and items kind of hanging on the wall, sitting on the floor. And then the other wall, again, had just a full wall of glass cases. And there hadn't been a concerted effort to interpret what was on display. So you would find something about the Johnson County Cattle War over here in the room, and then you'd walk across diagonally, and there might be another piece about the Cattle War. So it wasn't a cohesive learning experience. It was that kind of cabinet of curiosities display that was popular for a very, very long time and gives us all the base to work off of. But then we started a very slow process, because we did it all in-house, of organizing our story, putting it into that thematic kind of storyline for visitors to go through, determining not just what we had in the collection to tell people about, but also what makes Johnson County unique. You know, if you put yourself in the shoes of a family traveling, say they come from Oklahoma and they're going to Yellowstone, how many small-town museums have they stopped at, and how many have kind of the same story, and eventually you grow bored of it, and you don't want to stop at the next one? We have a lot of similarities with a lot of towns along anybody's path, but there's also things about this region that make us really special, and we wanted to pull those out and highlight that. So that was kind of our basis and why we started to remodel and change the museum. And I think that's been pivotal in keeping us relevant and keeping our visitation high.
So the award is a wonderful confidence boost, I'm sure.
Oh, for sure.
It really kind of, you know, must give you great comfort that what you've been doing is right and yeah. So on. What are your visions for the future? Where do you want to grow next?
That's a great question. There's three kind of specific things that are in my mind. One is literally taking care of our current facility. The 1909 Carnegie Library building, the exterior is crumbling on us. One of the beautiful things about the Carnegie Foundation and how they built these free public libraries across the U.S. was that they require the use of local workers and local materials. The downside for us is that that local material in question was sandstone and limestone, which tends to fall apart, especially if it hasn't had the appropriate care over the years. Frankly, our building hasn't, so we're trying to rectify that. We need to raise about $600,000 to take care of the building we are in. It's also, you know, a beautiful historic building. We love it. But it has its, you know, problems. So that is a big one for me. Another would be our reaccreditation process is going to be coming up sooner than I'd like to think about.
What is that?
So that's the American Alliance of Museums that I mentioned earlier. They have a process for museums to go through to achieve accreditation. You know, hospitals are accredited, schools are accredited. And again, it's that stamp of approval that this place is doing what they're supposed to be doing. That process is incredibly intensive. You send them all of your information. You have to go into your community, you solicit information, feedback from different folks within your region, travelers, etc. You send all of your financials, and then they actually send people on-site reviewers to verify that what you have sent them is accurate and real, and that you're not making it up, quite frankly. And then those folks send a report to a committee, they review it, and then they determine whether or not you have achieved, you know, in our case, maintaining the high standard. The last time we went through this, we really started the process in 2015. We didn't get our reaccreditation until February of 2018 because we failed at first. There were about four or five key things that they said, you're just not meeting good enough standards here. Here's your period of time. They gave us like 6 or 8 months to fix it. So they told us what they wanted. They gave us the opportunity to fix it, and we did.
Does accreditation, does that link to funding?
Yes.
Okay, so it's an important...
It is very important. You know, it's important internally for us because it is a huge affirmation that, again, what we're doing is good work. But it does have an effect on funding. Many grants agencies, they want to know, again, that where they're giving their money, where they're sending their funding to, is an appropriate place and is going to use it in the correct manner. We recently took in a substantial collection of mostly photographs and documents relating to the Bighorn National Forest from the United States Forest Service. So it encompasses Johnson County, Sheridan County, you know, even a little bit over the mountain. And if folks hear that and they think, well, how come that didn't go to Sheridan or some other museum? Two reasons. One was that the Forest Service needed the collection to be in a governmental agency, and we qualify as a county. And the other was that they required it to be an accredited museum because they wanted that collection, again, to have that kind of assurance that it was going to be cared for and processed correctly. And we met both of those standards. That collection is, you know, historically super important to us. It's fantastic information in there, but it also does come with some funding to take care of it. We couldn't have received the collection or the funding if we didn't have our accreditation status.
So you mentioned you're operating on about $330,000. Where does that money come from?
Good question. So it, you know, it fluctuates every year, but a little more than half comes from Johnson County Commissioners. So
it's a mill levy?
Yep, it's their mill levy. And if you get your property tax statement and you look at that, you'll see that the commissioners have a mill levy specific to them, and then they have to divvy that up to a pretty large number of other institutions and funds. the museum, library, and fairgrounds are all ancillaries. And to me, what that means is that our building and our artifacts are owned by the county. It is a county institution, but like I am not a county employee, I'm a museum employee, and the commissioners appoint 5 people to be our governing board. So it's kind of taking some responsibility of running the place off of the commissioner's plate, because frankly, they have enough going on. They're putting that responsibility on this volunteer governing board, and they provide the oversight. And we have an amazing governing board, by the way, which you know, doesn't always happen, so we are incredibly conscious and grateful for them. The rest of the funding for us comes in through admissions, store sales, grants, donations, and any kind of fundraising projects, the cemetery tours that Jen conducts every summer. Those usually bring in $4,000 or $5,000. Okay, that isn't going to make or break somebody's operating budget, right? But what it does do is provide funding the next year for more programming, for other events and things that she is working on. So we've learned, I think, better how to manage our money, how to live within our means, and also, I think, key thing is that by being really transparent and honest with our community about how we're funded and what we're using their dollars on, it actually garners more support.
So the award itself comes with a cash prize. It comes with $10,000. I mean, a not huge amount of money, but a real
substantial for us. Yeah.
So have you earmarked something for that?
I haven't yet. I want to discuss it with the board first, but what I suspect it might go into is the Carnegie Building. We have a really amazing opportunity for us right now. An anonymous supporter of the museum is willing to give us up to $30,000 in matching funds between now and August 31st. So any dollar that's donated to that fund, they'll match it on a one-for-one basis, right? That's, I mean, $60,000 is a chunk of change for us. We know we need about $600,000, but here's why I'm so optimistic. We not only have this fundraiser running, but the county commissioners have already set aside some capital improvement funds to help take care of this building. So they already got over $150,000, I think, set aside at the moment. So between them and us and our community, I think we're going to get this done. It's going to be a few years. We're going to try and kind of phase it out into smaller projects. The front of the building is the worst, so that's what we want to tackle first.
So you're actively seeking donations right now. Any amount will do?
Yes, any amount helps, truly. And the fun thing about this, too, is so that we have this matching fundraiser, but that doesn't mean we have to stop at $60,000. You know, if we bring in more than that, it stays within that capital campaign for the Carnegie Building. It will be used for that. It is tracked separately. I'm always happy to talk about our financials because, honestly, I'm really proud of what we have done with kind of a small fund. We have restricted funds that are, they belong to the museum solely. They cannot be absorbed back into the county budget because none of the dollars in those funds are tax dollars. They are all donations or grants. So that is how we have accomplished a lot of our projects. You know, the $330,000 operating budget is kind of what keeps us keeps the doors open, keeps us rolling. The restricted funds in those specific projects, that's how we have published books. That's how we have created walking tours. That's how we have started the art program. You know, now the art program is funded by other grants and donations, but that's where all of these things that are kind of extraneous but also vital to the museum, that's how they get done. It's literally from people donating their money to us.
Okay, so you're actively seeking local donations, any donations, donations right now, and I'll make sure that there is a link to how to do that. But 31st of August is an important date because then it can be matched.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. Well, Sylvia, thank you so much for spending some time talking about the museum, all the wonderful things on display. You know, I have to say I'm a museum lover, and I would encourage anybody who has not been through the museum to, you know, come and take a moment. It's full of rich and diverse history, and find out a lot about things that are right on our doorstep.
And remember, it's free for Johnson County residents now. Come utilize it. Come see us.
Okay, well, thank you very much indeed, and congratulations on a really significant award and for putting Johnson County on the map.
Thank you.